Islamic Republic of Iran's TV, and that has caused some problem to have more questions in this regard. And there are different explanations for NDE or near-death experiences. One important point is that although, as I mentioned, different people from different religions, they have the same experiences and different explanations, but some of the experiences are similar to each other.
Yes.
For example, of course, for some people, it is a very joyful experience. For example, they talk about a feeling of floating or silence, security, and seeing some lights and so on and so forth. And for some people, it is a very painful experience.
Yes.
With some pain and anxiety. But as I mentioned, they have some common experiences, like, for example, seeing a tunnel, seeing some realities of this world, and so on and so forth.
Presence of a light or absolute dissolution or exactly. Something like that. That's right. Okay.
Now, there are a couple of points. So we are talking about Islamic viewpoint. Can we trust these experiences or not? And can we bring us any theological message or not? The first point is that, and this is a very important point, that we shouldn't think that these people have experienced, death, and they are revived again. So what they see, what they tell us, is still at a time when they are in this world. Because as soon as a person passes away and there is a complete separation between the soul and the body, then there is no coming back to this world. This is a reality. So we cannot say that they have coming from another world. They have gone to the world of Barzakh, for example, and these experiences are coming from that world. No, for sure they are still alive.
Yes.
So we cannot call it life after death.
No.
They have not died. They are still alive. They are still in this world. So people should not think that they have gone to another realm, to another world, that is the world of Barzakh, and now they are telling us some experiences from that world. No. But one point is that I think all people can agree that these experiences at least can prove one point, and that is the existence of the soul. So usually people coming from, telling us NDE, near-death experiences, they are revealing some hidden points.
Yes.
And at the same time, they are telling us that at that situation during such experiences, they have been able to see different realities of this world at the same time. So is it possible through a physical body? Of course not. So I think one of the main messages of near-death experiences is the fact that it's not only this physical body. There is something more to it. And that is what we call it ruh, or the concept of soul. And of course, all the divine religions believe in it.
IRIB English Radio presents questions and answers on Islamic beliefs. Answering your theological questions in Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Send us your questions to EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
So for those people who think that this is only the material world, we are consisting of a physical body only, there is no soul, one of the answers to them is NDE. The experiences of these people can prove that it's not, I mean, this material life only. There is something beyond that, and we do, we should believe in the concept of the soul. For example, you see that many...
So it is not something related to brain or something like that? I mean, your memory is in the brain, because some critics of NDE say that, for example, during cardiac attacks, heart attacks or something like that, this is something physical happening in your brain rather than your soul. And the experiences that you talk about or you rememorize after, for example, you are getting back into this world are out of your brain.
This is, I mean, as I mentioned, there is a discussion between some scientists and some theologians that is it related to the soul or, as you mentioned, the brain. So some of the experiences for sure can be justified by this explanation of the scientists. For example, what they remember from the past. But the point is that the question is that in many of these experiences, people are informed of some of the realities of this world. So the person says that at the same time, I was watching different parts of this world. Mm-hmm. I mean, my city,
like
for example.
Like an eyewitness to the happenings.
Yeah, okay. I was in the hospital. I was watching what was going on in the hospital. At the same time, I was watching what was going on in my house and in different other places. So now the question is that, can we relate it to the brain too? Of course not. I mean, before that experience, and also sometimes they tell stories and realities about the places that they haven't been there before.
Yes.
So it has nothing to do with the brain. Mm-hmm. So, yes, when they tell us some stories about the past, some people may justify it through a scientific way by what you mentioned regarding the brain and what the brain remembers from the past. But the reality is that some of these experiences are revealing some facts in which the brain has no role. And it is only possible through something immaterial, which we call it soul or ruh.
Okay.
So this is one point. The second point is that, and this is a very important point, can these experiences prove any theological belief or not? And I want to put much emphasis on this, point and fact. Now, the question is that some people who discuss about NDE, they try to refer to these experiences to prove a theological point. So, for example, give some tangible examples. A Christian may say that in my NDE, I saw Jesus, for example, crucified. Mm-hmm. A Shia may claim that in my NDE, I saw Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam on the plain of Karbala with all those problems and sufferings. A Sunni might say in his NDE some good points regarding those caliphs that they believe in. A Hindu may say something related to his beliefs. Now, of course, what I'm saying is the viewpoint of some scholars and my humble viewpoint. There are some disagreements in this regard. I believe that NDE, near-death experience, cannot prove any theological belief. So you cannot say that I do believe in Christianity, in the cross, in crucifixion of Jesus, because these people have told me in their NDE that they have seen Jesus crucified and so on and so forth. As a Shia, I cannot prove the Imam of the Ahlul Bayt and the Shia school of thought and the tragedy of Karbala by saying that, okay, this person told me that in his NDE he saw Imam Hussein alayhi salam in the plain of Karbala. No, this is not a way to prove theological beliefs.
Yes.
This is not a way to prove some historical facts.
That's right.
So I think the main message that we can get from NDE is the existence of the soul. And of course, there are some moral and spiritual messages. The fact that all these people are talking about the fact that they have seen the consequences of their negative actions and the good rewards for their good actions. This is a reality. Okay. But when it comes to theological points, when it comes to historical events, we cannot get any authenticated message from these experiences.
That's all right. Thank you very much. But at least it is documented. So many research and studies have been done by different universities and scientists, okay? It is not only, for example, church or Muslims.
Sure.
So many scientists across the world have tested it, and according to some documents, they studied near-death experience and, experiments, which are documented, the scenes, the signs, the symbols are over there, which change it into a serious field of study nowadays around the world.
Exactly. It is an open field of study, many more research will be done in future.
That's all right. Thank you much, Sheikh Karim. It was very kind of you.
My pleasure.
And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir. قال في الإسلام بيش تينا هذا بسوك قبل السؤال في أمان الله
إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Commemorate the 23rd anniversary of the liberation of South Lebanon from Israeli occupation, Hezbollah conducted an unprecedented live military drill in the South Lebanese town of Aramta. After a show of hand-to-hand combat and a parade of all-terrain vehicles and motorcycles, the fighters launched a simulation of taking over an Israeli post in the occupied Galilee area. Over 100 media outlets covered the event, which many say is something unseen since before the liberation in 2000.
The location chosen for this is quite telling. First of all, it's close to the border with Israel. And, of course, this area back in before 2000 was under Israeli occupation. The old Bir Kalab outpost the Israelis had was just up on the hill behind us. So this is very familiar territory for Hezbollah.
The head of Hezbollah's executive council, Sayyid Hashem Safieddine, warned Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that his cabinet will not be able to change the rules of engagement.
Our message to Israel is clear. If you think that you can launch a full-scale aggression in order to strike the equations of deterrence, which we made with our blood and armaments and strength, we will be ready to shower you with precise rockets, and you will witness black days unlike any other. The Israeli regime knows what we mean. We will use our precise rockets and all means available to us.
Observers see that Hezbollah is primarily seeking psychological warfare against Israel with this maneuver.
But clearly the message is towards the Israelis primarily. As we've seen with the recent escalation in Gaza, we've seen a tightening of the ties, the military ties between Hezbollah, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and so on. So I think this show today feeds into that.
Hezbollah says the drill sent a message to the Israeli regime about the readiness of the resistance to deter enemy aggression and defend Lebanon. Israeli forces left most of southern Lebanon on May 25, 2000, after 22 years of occupation. Hezbollah's military drill is not merely a show of force, with prospects of a possible confrontation and continuous Israeli aggressions towards Al-Quds. Hezbollah wants to send a clear message to the Israelis that its deterrence capabilities remain intact. Mariam Saleh, South Lebanon.
UNICEF representative for Afghanistan says some 90% of the population in the country is on the brink of poverty, while children are the ones who are bearing the brunt of it. The UNICEF states some 2.3 million children in Afghanistan are expected to face malnutrition in the country, while roughly 1.6 million Afghan children, some as young as 6, are trapped in child labor, working in dangerous conditions just to help their parents put food on the table.
The children pick these waste materials and sell it to me. Instead of going to school, they work to earn a bread worth. These kids are doing this job out of necessity because some of them have sick parents and take care of them, or their parents have no job and tell the children to do this for a living. They can hardly buy bread with this earning.
Mohammad Qasem, a 12-year-old worker, says he can't go to a school because he should provide bread for the family.
I am 12 years old. I pick these puddles under the scorching sun to sell and buy bread for the family with this money. I don't go to school because I work every day to earn some money. It has been 3 years that I have been doing this.
Experts believe decades of war and unrest in the country is to blame for the poverty, which is compelling families to send their loved ones on the streets to find a mouthful. But of course, the negative consequences aren't negligible.
Most of the problems in the society originate from poverty. It is due to this poverty that our children are working on the streets. But we should keep in mind that the child who is working on the street is a lost valuable asset without a bright future for the country.
U.S.-led war in Afghanistan has ruined the country's economy. It has also made Afghanistan weapons contaminated too. 134 children were killed or maimed while collecting scrap metal to sell from explosive devices between January and March of this year alone. While Afghanistan is struggling to resolve problems left behind from decades of war, many people here believe U.S. sanctions and the reduction of activities of international organizations have made the situation more complicated in the country. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
The Islamic Jihad Resistance Movement has organized a celebration event in Damascus countryside, marking its victory against Israel in the recent battle in the Gaza Strip. In a televised speech, Secretary General of the movement, Ziad Nakhale, announced the victory against the Israeli regime, expressing pride in the people of Gaza, who he said manufactured their own weapons with the help of member countries of the resistance front.
We succeeded in the battle and we preserved Palestinians' unity. We proved to the enemy our continuous readiness to engage in battle after another in defense of our people. Any assassination operation will be met with a strong, clear and painful response in which Tel Aviv or other Israeli cities will be in the range of our rockets.
The event was attended by representatives of Syria-based Palestinian factions. Speakers said Palestinians and resistance groups showed unprecedented unity through the joint operations room while retaliating against Israel. They rejected any concessions with Israel and refused to acknowledge any political settlement with the enemy.
We underline the importance of national unity and armed resistance, which is the only option we have. We reject concessions, Oslo Accords, or any security coordination or recognition of Israel. We call for boycotting Israel politically and economically and punishing the enemy for the crimes against Palestinians.
Videos were played on a large screen showing the retaliatory battle codenamed Revenge of the Free, including images of the Islamic Jihad leaders who were assassinated or lost their lives while confronting Israeli attacks. Resistance movements like the Islamic Jihad believe that resistance is not an option, but in fact a national duty which is based on the legitimate right of Palestinians to fight against the Israeli regime. And for long, it has been the only successful deterrent against Israeli aggressions in occupied Palestine. Hamad Ali, Damascus Countryside.
Just a couple of weeks ago, there were hundreds of refugees, mainly from African and Middle Eastern countries, sleeping on the streets outside the main asylum application centre in Brussels. Authorities have since cleared the area. The refugees have fled to neighbouring countries or have been crammed into emergency accommodation. A few remain in the area, but say their situation would be different if they came from Ukraine.
Only because we are Afghan, because we come from Syria, because we don't have the same color, because we don't have same culture, but it will be not the reason. Of course, a lot of people, we have the same mind. I can work, I can do everything.
When you come here from Ukraine, you get everything. Accommodation, food, work, everything. If you are from somewhere else, as a refugee, you do not get anything.
If you look, I cut also myself, because we don't feel good in camp.
Sometimes you want to die?
Yes, I want to die. You look at my hands, I cut it my hands too much with blades. I do it too much. Because what is it, life, eat and going to sleep?
A debate in the European Parliament has heard that EU nations are erecting borders on land and strengthening aggressive coast guard services at sea. The bloc pays billions of euro to outside countries to stop refugees from attempting to travel here, unless they are from Ukraine.
The EU slogan is, break the business model of smugglers. But what we do is feeding them by blocking all pathways to protection.
There is a heavy far-right anti-refugee presence in the Parliament.
Europe needs a policy based on strong border control.
But many legislators are calling for a more civilized approach.
We already fund third countries like Libya, actually militias over there, to build camps, to host people there. And we see murder, we see rape, and we do not see a humane solution.
Key EU figures are currently in Hiroshima, Japan, for a G7 meeting. 350,000 people were living there when their closest ally, the United States, dropped its catastrophic atomic bomb in 1945. More support for Ukraine is high on the agenda. Critics say the last thing on their minds is providing refuge to those fleeing countries they helped destabilise in Africa, Asia and the Middle East. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
For the first time since massive regular protests began in January, the French government has held discussions with union leaders regarding a 2-year hike to the retirement age. A notable problem with that long delay is that the age hike has already been forced into law via a decree by President Emmanuel Macron. Public opinion is overwhelmingly against the change, but the government is standing firm, even though anger is rising to threatening levels nationwide. The First Lady's nephew was recently beaten by protesters over the age hike. Over 60% of the country wants the Prime Minister fired, and neither Macron nor his ministers can appear in public without protesters noisily banging casserole pans.
There's enormous anger right now. Macron has destroyed our social services, given huge tax gifts to the rich, persecuted injustices while allowing the far right to demonstrate without barely any police presence. And this is not even a complete list. People just want to live normally. But the Macron era is one of sadness and poverty.
Unions say the country will not get back to normal unless the age hike is revoked. But France has seen massive anti-government unrest regularly for well over a decade, and usually over far-right austerity measures. France and the European Union continue to be hounded by accusations that they are anti-democratic, and the latest of many French presidential decrees has only further increased dissatisfaction and dissent.
There is growing realization that our major national policies are decided in Brussels, and that our president is a mere puppet. We're also subservient to Washington. Simply look at what we're doing in Ukraine for more proof. So there's no hope that we'll have democracy during the last 4 years of Macron's term. But if we don't get it in 2027, things will explode.
Union leaders left the closed-door meeting, calling it not useful and a one-way monologue.
The pension age hike has overshadowed other crises, such as record inflation, the arming of the unrest in Ukraine, and stagnant wages. But all of those remain unresolved flashpoints as well. Barring a surprise reversal from the government, unions are planning a 14th day of nationwide strikes next month. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Hundreds of Orthodox Jews protested outside the UK Parliament building on Tuesday over fears the establishment will begin regulating traditional Jewish faith schools known as yeshivot. Protest leaders made clear they considered any legislation targeting unregulated Jewish religious institutions as anti-Semitic, and they may be forced to flee Britain to protect their religious freedoms from unwelcome reforms.
Today, we face a concerning challenge as politicians attempt to push through a proposed register for children educated outside of school. This is no ordinary bill, but one that seeks to sneak in new laws through the back door under the guise of a private member's bill. This register proposal targets our strictly Orthodox Jewish community, intending to undermine our way of life more than any other group. It reeks of state-sponsored anti-Semitism.
What concerns these religious Jewish parents is regulated British education mandates lessons on lifestyles which contradict Jewish religious beliefs, including relationship and sex education, or RSE, LGBT propaganda, and other anti-religious ideologies, including atheism.
Well, we're not talking about murdering anybody. We're just talking about what we don't want our children to be taught. And we're just following what it says in our religion. And it's absolutely disgraceful that you're not allowed to do that in this country. And that's anti-Semitic.
These protests come after years of public anger expressed by parents, particularly British Muslims, over RSE lessons already being implemented in state schools. Opt-out options are not available, and accusations of indoctrination or anti-religious propaganda being fed to young children has been rife. In January 2023, a petition went viral, gaining over 200,000 signatures, demanding the government remove LGBT teaching from the controversial curriculum. The government responded, saying,
"The statutory guidance states that all pupils should receive teaching on LGBT content during their school years. Secondary schools should include LGBT content in their teaching. Primary schools are strongly encouraged and enabled when teaching about different types of family to include families with same-sex parents."
The ruling Conservative government has routinely attacked left-wing opposition over their support for the Palestinian cause and their criticism of Britain's relationship with the Israeli regime. However, and quite ironically, it's now number 10 that finds itself on the receiving end of not only accusations of anti-Semitism, but also Islamophobia and for being anti-religion in general, over an education system which is perceived to be discriminating against religious minority rights. Robert Carter, London.
The Japanese city of Hiroshima is set to host a G7 summit this week, where leaders of the U.S., Britain, France, Germany, Canada, Italy, and Japan will address pressing global issues. The meeting is also a source of controversy in other countries around the world, including South Korea, where activists at a Seoul forum slammed the event as diplomatic whitewashing.
This summit is a tool to conceal the terrible truth that countless Asian and Pacific people had to bleed due to 50 years of Japanese imperialism beginning in the late 19th century. It's a blindfold to cover Japan's hypocritical steps towards a nuclear-free world, peace, and rearmament, while dumping nuclear-contaminated water and scrapping its peace constitution.
South Korea's relations with Japan have always been controversial, but especially now as President Yoon Suk-yeol has sought to improve ties against the wishes of many South Koreans, who demand an apology for what they call Japan's colonial abuses. As world leaders flock to Hiroshima, South Koreans are reminded of a history the U.S. and Japan might rather forget. When the U.S. dropped the atomic bombs on Japan, in addition to more than 200,000 Japanese, estimates suggest some 40,000 Koreans were killed. Many of them were forced laborers.
Some South Koreans say President Yoon is moving the country too close to the United States and a military alliance with Japan, which is seen as increasing regional tension. Japanese leader Fumio Kishida invited Yoon to the G7.
The South Korean government's participation is mainly to strengthen military cooperation between South Korea, the U.S., and Japan, and further strengthen military cooperation with NATO, which is mainly led by the United States. If South Korea's participation in the G7 was to reinforce the military alliance as a benefit, that can never be a good thing for the peace of the Korean Peninsula, as well as world peace.
While the summit plans to address the Russia-Ukraine war and economic issues, activists also argue the rich G7 nations need to do more to solve the humanitarian crisis now unfolding in East Africa. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A new report by the Institute of Watson Brown on their Cost of War project, which evaluates the results of the post-9/11 wars on affected countries, says the post-9/11 wars have caused more than 4.5 million people to lose their life in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, and Pakistan. This study says that some of these people were killed in the war, but a larger number died indirectly due to the destructive effects of the war, which reaches 3.7 million people.
These mentioned casualties have different reasons. One is that the treatment centers have been destroyed due to war, and medical aid seekers could not access treatment. Also, the widespread of diseases due to lack of health centers is countable. We can even refer to using bombs and weapons used in war that had environmental consequences that affected people. Overall destruction of infrastructures and long-term effects of the war is the main reason for casualties.
According to the report, tens of millions of people living in the war zones have also been displaced. The U.S. post-9/11 wars have forcibly displaced at least 38 million people in and from Afghanistan and the other mentioned countries.
Taking responsibility has three steps. First is to acknowledge they are the cause of this destruction and misery, which they don't. Second is ethical acceptance of the results of what they have done. And finally, there should be a higher power to compel them to take responsibility for what they have done. Some might say the UN is a higher power. Still, the UN is created by some countries which have the right or the veto right, and it shows flexibility towards these countries. There is simply no base on which these countries take responsibility.
The results of the war imposed by the U.S. on Afghanistan are the shocking numbers of 30% rise in food insecurity, 41% increase in children malnutrition and rising poverty, 1.5 million people left with disabilities and 2 million widows. Poverty, unemployment and poor medical conditions are considered only some of the results of 20 years of U.S. military presence in Afghanistan. Despite the fact that the war is over, people are still facing challenges due to the effects of that war. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
China has questioned the credibility of G7 members. Beijing has accused the US-led Group of Seven of trying to impose its will on others. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT noted the international community will not allow the US-led G7 dominate world affairs, nor will it fall in line with the pro-Western rules pushed by the group, the Chinese Foreign Ministry said in a statement recently. The statement read, China will never accept the so-called rules imposed by the few. The international community does not and will not accept the G7-dominated Western rules that seek to divide the world based on ideologies and values. The foreign ministry went on to accuse the group of acting on behalf of America First policies and attempting to impose its will on others. The ministry said, that simply shows how little international credibility means to the G7. The Group of Seven is an informal club consisting of the US, Canada, Britain, France, Germany, Italy, and Japan. The annual meetings are also typically attended by officials representing the EU. In a joint communique adopted at the summit in Hiroshima, Japan recently, the G7 listed multiple allegations aimed at Beijing. The group said that it strongly opposes any unilateral attempts to change the status quo by force regarding Taiwan and the South China Sea. Beijing responded by saying that affairs related to Hong Kong, Xinjiang, and Tibet are purely China's internal affairs. China has accused the G7 of endangering peace in the region by providing support for Taiwan independence forces. Although G7 members refrain from formally establishing diplomatic ties with Taiwan, the U.S. has sold weapons to Taipei and promised to defend it from a potential attack from the mainland. U.S. politicians have also met with officials in Taiwan, prompting harsh criticism from Beijing, which opposes any form of diplomatic contacts with the Taipei authorities. According to Bloomberg, reports predict a significant shift in global economic power as BRICS nations are on track to surpass the G7 countries in economic growth. By 2028, the collective GDP of the BRICS countries, including Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, is expected to reach nearly 35%, driven by China's anticipated position at the top source of world growth over the next 5 years, according to the International Monetary Fund, IMF. China is projected to contribute 22.6% to global GDP growth through 2028, followed closely by India at 12.9%. In contrast, the U.S. is expected to contribute only 11.3%. The report notes that the global economic outlook is currently at its weakest in over three decades due to various macroeconomic developments, with 75% of global growth expected to be concentrated in just 20 countries. The top four contributors, two of which are BRICS nations, China and India, will account for half of the growth. Comparatively, the G7 nations represent a smaller share, with Germany, Japan, and the UK as the top 10 contributors. The BRICS countries currently contribute 31.5% of global GDP, while the G7's share has decreased to 30%. By 2030, the BRICS nations are expected to account for over 50% of global GDP, with this figure potentially rising further as the bloc expands. Recent additions to the BRICS New Development Bank, such as Bangladesh, Egypt, and the UAE, demonstrate the growth trajectory of the bloc. Furthermore, Mexico, long part of the North American Free Trade Bloc, NAFTA, now superseded by the Canada-United States-Mexico Agreement, CUSMA, is poised to join BRICS. This move could be seen as a direct affront to Mexico's relationship with the United States and a signal that global economies, even those on America's border, are questioning the U.S. ability to trade on fair and equal terms. As the BRICS nations gain more influence on the global stage, they are likely to push for reforms within international institutions like the United Nations, World Bank, International Monetary Fund, IMF, World Trade Organization, and World Health Organization. This shift may lead to a more multipolar world, where power is more evenly distributed among the major global players. The BRICS nations' projected economic growth presents a challenge to the dominance of the G7 countries on the world stage. As the balance of power continues to shift, it will be crucial for global leaders to adapt and find ways to work together to address issues and foster international cooperation. The coming years will reveal whether the world can successfully navigate this transition and forge a more inclusive and equitable global economic order.
Start. Movement. Speed. Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamidi.
Islamidi.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all of time.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. Welcome to a new episode of Youth Station. This is IRB English Radio and I am Asma at your service. And here with me I have Brother Habib. Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you guys for having me and welcome to our show. What are we going to be talking about, sister?
Well, the question that we all had from the time when we were kids. Is it just a predestined sort of a story that I'm going to leave or no? My work and my effort are going to make some difference. Is my future in my hand or in God's hand?
See, I think that this is there might be a misconception about the theological aspect of free will and whatnot.
Yeah.
I want to just point it out that every action we do isn't the power and will of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yeah.
You're able to move, talk, look at that green thing that's in front of you, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gave you the power to do so. He placed laws, which we call laws of physics for some reason, and He placed the power in you. And the best example is like what Sayyid al-Khu'i brought up, one of the great scholars, passed away recently, 40 years peace, is that a person is alive on a battery. The battery is plugged into the charger. It's plugged into to electricity. The person could do whatever he wants, but as long as there's that electricity, when the electricity goes, the person dies.
Yeah.
So the same thing with the power that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala bestowed with us. you're doing, you're moving, you're saying whatever, mm-hmm. because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gave you the capability to do so.
So, you know the story of the road not taken. I don't know if you have read that poem or not, but it's a beautiful poem. I would recommend everyone to go and read that.
Right.
It talks about, just as the title talks and says it all, the road not taken. In life, we usually are put in a situation where we have to pick between two. So what happens to me that I pick one of them and not the other?
That's your choice. It does go back to
what about the destiny?
No, you choose yourself.
You said that I need electricity.
I'm just going like this electricity.
I need that electricity.
You need that power, true.
Yeah.
But it's your choice at the end of the day. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gave you the power.
Mm-hmm.
Allah gave you the power to choose. Allah gave you the power to pick.
Yeah.
You're the one that chose to take this path.
And still, I'm more inclined to one of them. So this intention that I have toward one of them.
That really goes back to you.
That this predilection that I have toward one of these roads.
There's going to be context.
Is it something that has been put in me or
no,
I have it?
You have it. You have context to it. Because for example, there were two roads.
Yeah.
You had no prejudice, pre-context whatsoever. New roads. You didn't know each one where it would take you. They're the same exact roads.
Yeah.
They look the same exact thing, right?
So what is the role of destiny in here?
What do you mean destiny?
Things that have been written for me as a human being.
You write your own destiny.
It's all your choice.
It's all your choice. The wealth, that's also in your hands as well, especially with the concept of the Shia concept of bid'ah, which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is all capable of changing, right?
Yeah.
For example, you give sadaqah, mm-hmm. your life prolongs. You disrespect your parents, your life shortens, decreases. You do this, your wealth increases. You do that, your wealth decreases. There are some things that are in our hands that have been written down. That's not a problem. But the thing is, it was your choice.
Mm-hmm.
It was with your hands. You're the one that's doing sadaqah. You're the
yeah.
one that's choosing this. You're the one that's choosing that. It goes back to you. And of course, if it was going back to Allah, choosing this or that, why would He punish me?
Yeah, so I have a question, but I'd rather to ask it after the break.
Go ahead.
Welcome back. We're still on Youth Station, and I have this question. So you were saying that there's no destiny, and I would do everything by choice.
Yeah.
What about the choices that I have no turn in them? There are some situations in which they have been imposed on you. Like earthquake happens, and you have to migrate to another city. This is not your choice. Is it your choice?
It is my choice to migrate from another city. Even though that there's an earthquake, all right, it happened, an earthquake, my house got demolished.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a house to sit down on, but I can stay in this place.
Okay, but this is not your plan.
It wasn't my plan. Who cares if it was my plan or not?
So we're talking about free wills.
That's what I'm trying to put forward, that we have the free will to choose. We have the free will to do.
It's by force that I'm choosing.
No, it's not by force. Why did I migrate?
Because I have to go, because really? There's nothing else there.
That's because you see that your situation is in a place where you have to move.
Mm-hmm.
But if you stayed, you could have stayed.
Yeah, there are too many examples. I guess those who are hearing right now might ask too many questions. And you might have seen around yourself.
Yeah.
You see, there are many situations in life that you would just sit and ask yourself, this is not my free will.
There are things that are out of my hands. For example, like my parents moving me to another country when I was young.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't in my hands. I was forced by my parents.
So?
That's true.
Mm-hmm.
But it was my parents' action. It wasn't my action.
It wasn't
my parents'
free will.
Action. It wasn't of course, with my free will.
Mm-hmm.
But there's this thing that, of course, it was someone else's fault. It was someone else's decision that affected me.
Yeah.
And of course, you can also play a role. You can also play a role in other people's life.
No, when you're younger, when you're a kid, you have no role. in making decisions.
Of course, I know, I understand. But at the end of the day, every human being has the possibility, the capability of changing the lives of others.
Mm-hmm.
Either in a positive way or a negative way. For example, a man came up and brought me $10,000. That would change my life. Would it change my
life?
It would change your life as well. But to a positive way.
Mm-hmm.
Someone can come up and steal my house, rob my house.
That's a higher power, you know. In life, there are some higher powers that would decide for you in some situation, just like the examples you gave away.
Yeah.
When you're a kid, your parents are more powerful than you. So they would be the ones who have the free will upon you. The boss you have is going to be the one who is in a higher power, so he or she is going to be the one who is going to have the free will.
Okay. But what does that do with my actions? I want to talk about a specific scenario.
Yeah.
For example, because of the conditions that you lived in and whatever, the country that you lived in, the political situation, the economical situation.
Yes.
But you had the chance to study well and become, for example, the best doctor in your country.
No. Okay, let me add to that scenario some more of details. Just imagine there is a family, they've lost their father. The boy have to work.
Right.
Because, of course, the mother and the sister, they need money for life.
Okay.
So how is he going to improve himself and study at the same time of working?
It does become harder for him, yes. It does become harder. No one's denying that.
So don't you believe that if he had a father and if he had someone to support him, then he would have been better off with his education?
The chance of being better would have been more, yes. But doesn't mean necessarily. Some people have everything in front of them.
Yeah.
But still, they don't reach their potential.
No.
Why is that?
You know, they're doing sacrifices for other people.
No.
So it's not just the free will.
No. You're taking examples of people who are having low chances. What about the people who have high chances of successfulness,
mm-hmm.
right? The person has the best school, the best studies, the best books, the best teachers, a rich family, nothing else to care about other than his studies.
Yeah.
Yet he doesn't reach.
Maybe they have mental issues. Maybe they have family issues.
He's mentally good. No family. I'm bringing up an example.
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
What I want to say is that at the end of the day, the best answer for why didn't he study, is because why did he fail, is because he didn't study. He himself, with his own actions.
Okay, if you go and talk to him, if you dig deeper inside their brain, then you would get into some reasons why he didn't study.
No, some people accept the fact that they could have done better. There are a lot of people who accept the fact that they could have done better. A lot of people slack. You can't deny that. Everyone has their potential.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's potential is different. Your potential, for example, to be in linguistics is way higher than mine's, right? But if you get stacking and I work hard, I can be better than you.
Yeah, I do believe that.
Why is that? It's because it's my hands.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I have these hardships, right? I have this too many problems in my life. I don't know, always busy and whatnot. But I always find the time, for example, to make a program for myself. I believe that if you want to do something, you put your mind to it,
mm-hmm.
you can reach it.
But trust me, sometimes it doesn't work.
Sometimes it doesn't work out, but it's not your fault.
So see the concept of free will, where it goes.
It's not
sitting in a corner.
You're working,
laughing.
You did what you did. You're doing what you could have done.
Yeah.
You're doing what you could have done, right?
Yeah.
That's the important thing.
Okay, let's go for a break, and then I have a question to ask.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Well, we're talking about free will and the concept of destiny and whatsoever. So just, I do believe that there is a destiny.
Like destiny, like it's been written down in the stars that you're going to be this
and
be that.
Okay, let's not just make it that dramatic. But
what is
there
it?
Is a higher power that distinguishes your future. I mean, at least if it's not going to pick that future for you, it would have a hand in it.
Of course, there's going to be a hand in everything.
So there is no free will.
No, there is free will.
No, it's not free will.
That's
when I have to pick something, two choices are in front of me, but none of them are my choices.
Did you pick or not?
I have to pick.
You have to pick one of the two?
Yeah.
But did you pick?
at the first place. No, no, it was not my free will to get into this road.
You're in the situation right now.
Mm-hmm.
You're in the situation. You either pick A or B.
Yes.
Which one are you picking?
A or B.
A or B. Yes. You picked at the end of the day.
As long as we're a human being, yeah, we're living, we have to go on.
But I don't blame it on the higher powers. Sometimes.
No, there's no blame. See, there's no blame. We're human beings and we have a creator and there's this entire world that works based on a rule.
I'm talking about more, look, because at the end of the day, you're put in the situation most because of the parents' actions.
Mm-hmm.
Especially as a child who's been negligated or a child who's been, you know, went through hell in his life, in his childhood. This really goes back to the family members that he had. Life is full of consequences. Every action you do, whether you like it or not, it has a consequence. This consequence can be forcing another person to do this and that.
Yeah.
It's a consequence. Like I brought up an example. Someone coming and stealing your house.
And I was just telling you, see, the situation is the thing that would get, that would entrap you, your free will.
But the thing is that we weren't agreeing on the same terminology. The free will that I was talking about is different to what you were trying to put forward.
Yeah.
What I was talking about is the action. Like, for example, me lifting this, right? Or mm-hmm. me choosing this or choosing that.
Very
whatever
clearly, yeah.
Yeah, but the free will that you were talking about is like, you choose your situation, you choose your genre, you choose your concept.
Yeah, yeah.
That really sometimes, yes, most of the time.
And we even have it in our narrations that human beings are not totally free.
Not totally free.
We are somehow
I said at the beginning of the show, I want to leave that out because it's talking about a different concept.
Yeah.
It's a very deep concept in theology. Mm-hmm. It has to do with the Jewish concept of tafwi that was put forward in the Islamic nation. And I want to leave that alone. I don't want to go to say that the narrations are stating this and stating
so
that.
Just say what's the statement. We are in the midway.
Like, لا جبر ولا تفويض وإنما أمر بين أمرين. That's the saying, and the understanding of it is, it differs. The mainstream understanding may differ to the true understanding available in the words of the muhaddithin, such as Sheikh al-Saduq and Sheikh al-Kulaini.
So we were talking about the concept of free will and destiny, and you know, the ideas differ from each other, and everybody could have their own ideology. And still, I think that as human beings, we all, yes, we have the power to choose, but sometimes the situation is just put in front of us. And we have no, I'm sorry to say that, brother, but that's my conclusion.
Yeah,
we are somehow the product of the situations.
It's in your hands at the end of the day. Go and do whatever you want.
Yeah, thank you. And that's it. And that's it. That was all the time that we had. Until another session, I just bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Peace out.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.